Welcome back, listeners, to the fourth year, can you believe it, fourth year already of the Religious Studies Project. I'm David Robertson, and my co-host is...
It's Christopher Cotter.
And I'm as excited as can be to kick off the new season.
Absolutely. We'll tell you a bit more about the new season after the interview, but in our sort of time-honoured style, I think we'll just kick straight into it.
Yes, this interview is with Alexandra Greaser. And it's on the subject of religion and memory, and it's and she is being interviewed by my good friend Christopher Cotter. So take it away, Chris and Alexandra.
Welcome to the Religious Studies Project. This is an interview from the Irish Society for the Academic Study of Religion conference in Belfast. I'm here with Dr. Alexandra Greaser, who is the assistant professor for the theory of religion at Trinity College Dublin. So, welcome to the Religious Studies Project.
Thank you. It's an honour to be interviewed by you.
This conference has been on religion and remembering, which is obviously a sort of particularly potent topic to be discussing in Ireland, particularly, I guess, you know, the whole idea of, you know, cultural memory and things like that. And it suddenly hit me coming to this conference that we haven't featured a podcast discussing this whole idea of religion and memory, which is quite surprising given that I was at Edinburgh and still live in Edinburgh, and I've heard Jim Cox go on and, you know, about Danielle Hervieux-Léger quite a bit. So I thought this conference, saw what you were presenting on, saw your presentation and thought this would make a good interview just to discuss the whole broad topic of religion and memory, or I guess also religious studies and memory. So I guess we could just kick off with what is religion and memory? Where has this idea come from? What makes memory different? Is it not just tradition? I think he asked that in one of those papers yesterday. Mm-hmm. I've been quite confused throughout the conference. What's the difference between tradition and memory?
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge topic, of course, a vast topic. And the interesting thing is often to discern on what level are we talking. And such a question like, what's the difference between memory and tradition?
yeah,
now, it's a great entrance, actually, because only the approach... or you were talking about a new approach, allows us to make this distinction, which is great.
Mm.
And I would say as a framework, such a topic like relating religion to another, as a concept to another concept as memory would be, or remembering, which is, again, a different concept, of course, is a consequence of the cultural turn within the study of religion. And actually, this is a very, I think, very fruitful way not to think about religion as something isolated, or the nice question students sometimes have, but after all the contextualization, could you not tell me what Islam in itself is?
Yeah.
A Scandinavian colleague said that once. And that you always need to answer, there is no Islam in itself, no religion in itself. So this concept of relating the concept of religion with a different concept is, I think, a consequence, really, thinking differently and more methodologically about religion. This is at least how I understand this as an invitation to think how we can relate religion to memory. So, and this allows also, in my understanding, to explore a bit what can you do with such a concept of interrelating religion and memory. There we can start.
Yeah.
And also kind of mapping a bit a field which is really vast, because as I said yesterday, this brings up very important systematic questions for our field. Questions such as, how does religion take part in creating a historical past, a way to think which is not self-evident, that we think in terms of history. And the way we are thinking in terms of history, I think is, we can say, is no longer, okay, we do have history, of course, in antiquity. But the way we think about future and past is a completely romantic and an enlightenment topic for European understanding. So this is the first exciting thing to think about. Hey, what is actually thinking in terms of historical past? And then, of course, the second element I would point out is the concept of remembering as part of an individual identity. So how do we create ourselves as subjects, as, you know, creatures who have a life which only can be grasped as life through a narrative, for example, or, you know, all the metaphors we have that you travel your life, or that you need to kind of make sense narrative on the basis of narratives, that you change something in your life, that there is a before and an after. So this is also kind of a memory or approach to memory where religion can play a role, and where you have kind of tools then to say, okay, how do people use narratives to, for example, make plausible religious change in their life on the one hand, but also the other way around, how do they use the narratives to, how do they use religious narratives to make sense of their lives, so to say? And this also, you know, this tension between the individual role of religion, memory, relationships, and the relationship, the concept of cultural and historical relationship between religion and memory. This is something I would also like to interrelate again. And there we see, okay, with this concept of religion and memory, we can really figure out a network of relationships where then it becomes interesting to say, what kind of theory does help us to understand this knot in the net, so to say? And how we can we understand then in a, as you said, in a complex situation like Ireland, where can we, what not, what investigation of what not would us, would help us to understand better what happens and what we also want to maybe change in how things are happening here.
Thanks for that very useful introduction there. I guess one way to ask this would be, what does studying religion and memory avoid, or why, what does it help us avoid? What methodological and sort of theoretical pitfalls does it, like obviously it'll have its own pitfalls, but, you know, what does it bring that sort of, like Professor Cox last night was talking about, you know, as a sort of middle way between substantivist and functionalist approaches.
Okay, so you asked also what kind of a theory of religion would it offer, or definition of religion would it offer? That would be another knot in the net, I would, I would call it. Because what James Cox wonderfully did yesterday was, of course, to use the theory of memory in order to define religion. So applying a theory of memory or an aspect of memory to understand what religion could be. And religion could be not in the sense of an essentialist definition, that was also the interest of Danielle Hervieux-Léger, of course, as a sociologist. She was interested in setting up a definition which is a working definition, which is our task to use. And at the same time, to enable us to distinguish our field. So I must say I'm a little bit astonished at, over and again about this discussion, because it mixes up again and again whether we are using distinctions to determine our field, or are again talking about what is religion and what not. And I think this is a different question. What is our field, and what do we work on, and how do we distinguish it from other areas of society, and what is a full, half, pseudo, whatever religion? Is it different? We still try to label this then in a way. But it is, of course, very legitimate and an interesting thing to say, let's talk about religious traditions. Let's try to define, and define always means to cut it out of a larger, you know, complexity of social practices. And doing this on the basis of theory of memory is a great idea, of course. I'm not so sure about this kind of finalizing thing. This is then religion and everything else is not religion. Let's come to that a little bit later, because there, I think there are phenomena which we should describe and which do not fit in this definition. But first of all, the idea of religion being a chain of memory, providing certain specific strategies to keep a memory not just alive, but legitimizing it in an authoritative way. This helps, of course, to understand that the amazing, in a way, and I don't mean that valuing, but the amazing fact that religions keep a system of meaning, a system of practice alive over thousands of years, with reference to texts, with reference to authorities like human beings, with reference to strange strategies like revelation, which is so powerful, with strategies such as embodied practices, which you don't need to believe because you know what's happening. I mean, if you feel the spirit, you don't need to believe in it. Yeah. So, yeah, these specific religious strategies. So I think we can learn a lot from this view to understand what religion is able to do. And we also can learn a lot from these strategies to understand how, for example, political, especially, of course, nationalistic memory is working, cultural practices of enacting and legitimizing the dominant memory, for example, because we can see what kind of religious strategies, aesthetic forms, argumentative forms are taken over, you know, especially in the 19th century, by nation states. So it's not that we only, you know, that we as scholars of religion are only fixated on religion, but often is what we know from religion helps us a lot to understand political and even exchange processes. That's the one point. And I think that Hervé Léger has made a wonderful step with this. What I wonder about is why does she still use, I mean, we talked about the criticism that was about this already. Why does she still, let's say, put the belief category as an upper category and the enacted practices and the, what is the topic, acting belief as a subcategory? Yeah. Because I think there it becomes interesting that belief is not, it's not like the Protestant idea that there is the belief as the upper category and everything else expresses, symbolizes, or just supports the belief. But this is, of course, the discussion the wonderful discussion we had with James Cox yesterday. What do we understand as belief?
Yeah, because that's something that we could go on to then. It is, a lot of scholars seem to, to my mind, sort of pay extended lip service to the idea of I'm going to treat religion as a chain of memory, or I'm going to talk about religious traditions. And then once they've done that, then immediately to start talking about religion in the same old way that they would have always talked about it, it becomes discussions of belief again. And I wonder how much this is to do, I've always wondered how much this is to do with the fact that you have to put things into words, even if it's embodied experience or embodied memory, it only makes sense when it is articulated to someone else, and they write it down, and then it becomes discursive, and then it becomes intellectualized, and then it, hey presto, we're all back to belief again. I wonder if we can ever really get away from that sort of always ending up at the cerebral, because even if you focus on material aspects of religion, it has to be articulated for us to write about it.
Yeah, but this is, you give me a red carpet, of course, for pledge for complexity in this case, and that this relationship between religion and memory can offer us a tool to unfold this complexity. And am I supposed to write you to ask you back what you're? Yeah, I mean, I hear a critical, an analytical idea in what you're saying, because this is exactly the point. How can we learn to offer tools for the analysis of the interaction of enacted? Let's take the example: enacted memory, embodied memory, the intellectual reflection on it. The cultural. Let's call it technologies of cultivating the embodiment and the imaginations and arguments we are making on it. This is a complexity I think we have to describe.
Yeah.
But we need a framework for. And this is the reason that I think we need frameworks in different frameworks, and exactly this kind of relationship: religion and memory, religion and society, religion and political science. This is exactly how we can theorize different concepts and angles from which we can describe this complexity. Mm-hmm. And then we need to bring it together again. Mm-hmm. And of course, I mean, we talked about it. My work of the last 4 years was bringing together religion and perception. This is exactly why I think it's a good idea to talk about an aesthetic perspective to religion, because it enables us to look at what you said, the embodiment, the perception, the basis of how we perceive the world, how we make sense of the world from our senses. At the same time, develop, externalize complex systems of, artifacts, technologies, let's say dance as a technology, religious practice as a technology. If you bow and do something with your body 5 times a day, this is not a matter of you do it theoretically. This does something with your body, with your expectations. And there are even things like, if you don't do it, you miss something, and not on the theoretical level. Mm. So there are effects which we need to describe, but at the same time, I think the discussion of only the material side of culture is a bit, short of then relating it to the historical concepts, to the reflective concepts. So it's still a task to describe the interrelation.
Yep.
And I think that, for example, the idea of analyzing aesthetic forms, Birgit Meyer has this strong sensational forms, this term, that it's quite interesting also how we need to do this methodologically, and then observe, for example, how these aesthetic forms developed historically, were changed. And then we have a little bit of a different databases to compare it to the interpretive systems, which I find a much better word than belief.
Yeah.
Interpretive systems, because I think you can relate to doctrines, ideas, intellectual concepts in very different ways. Mm. It's not just that you can relate to them in terms of believing. You can make them relevant in a different way. And I mean, there we are, in the middle of talking about modern forms of religion. I don't think that belief is a concept which helps us to understand how people make sense of their life on the basis of referring to religious concepts, also critically, also kind of on demand, that they find them plausible or attractive. And this is often kind of, downplayed a bit, that it's just the supermarket. And I think what I observe, for example, in my little fieldwork on Western Buddhism, is that people engage very much in negotiating with themselves and not taking up easily a new belief, but and also not just taking up this argument, you don't need to believe, but you can experience. It's not an easy way they take it up, but they really go through discussions, doubts. They are ready to or even willing to find a kind of arguments and experiences which they, how do you say that, compare to what they don't want anymore, so to say.
Yeah.
So they are very serious elements of this.
Yeah. And this all relates sort of nicely back to the you know, memory, because beliefs, if we want to call them that, only, they don't just tend to come around. People don't tend to have road to Damascus sort of moments. It's within...
some people have.
Some people do. Some people do.
They are enlightened in 5 minutes, they told me.
But they would still need to have some sort of memory
again,
within which to articulate what that experience was. So,
and of course, we would describe the year before the 5 minutes, okay?
Yeah, as building up the context
exactly,
within which it,
exactly.
Which it occurs. So yesterday in your presentation, what we've been talking about now is sort of largely, I guess, sort of cultural ideas of memory. But in your presentation yesterday, you also brought in a cognitive angle to it, which is sort of almost entirely alien to me, but I'm aware that, you know, as soon as you mentioned it, I was like, of course, that makes sense. People who are in cognitive science are going to have a very sort of different understanding of memory and a different approach to it. So maybe you could take us through that, what you laid out yesterday, because there was a very important gap that you identified.
Yeah, thank you. Because this is also a nice chance we have if we are such a, you know, have these open concepts of how do we relate relation to memory. It's the opportunity to dive into the concept of memory to understand more of religion. And memory, of course, is something which for cultural studies we sometimes already think we know what it is.
Mm.
You know, when we bow our knees and have these all these rituals, the national rituals, this is how memory is enacted. And I think it's interesting to take up knowledge from the natural sciences, and especially, of course, perceptual psychology, the really exploding field of cognitive studies and evolutionary studies of religion, and get into dialogue, which is, of course, as we all know, not an easy one, because we need to find a language which functions for both sides, mm-hmm. and a respectful understanding of the theories of the other side, so to say. But I still think it's a really interesting thing to exchange the models and see what you can do with the models and go deeper in understanding religion. So what I tried to offer was to ask what do we actually mean if we talk about memory? And taking up a little bit of brain research, we set up a little research group in Groningen where a semiotician dared to really make a big picture of a theory of culture, starting by the idea that that the bilateral form of the brain allows us to decouple, so to say, decouple the actual perception of where we are,
mm-hmm.
from a stable, basic, constant pattern of memory, which secures us, you know, in where we are and where we find ourselves in reality.
Yeah.
So that this basic function determines that we are able to create what we call memory, that we experience a difference between here and yesterday, that we experience a difference between the place where we are and the place that we are able to imagine a place where we are not.
Yeah. Is that to do, sorry to jump in, like with the fact that we're, you know, we're sitting in this room and I can't see what's behind me at this moment in time, but when I came into the room and sat there and, you know, I saw it and I can picture it in my head, so I feel secure, but that's not I'm not perceiving it, but I know it's there. It's in my memory. Is that
exactly? Exactly. This, and this is, of course, something all animals, and we are in this sense also animals, are able to create schema. Hmm. A schema. You know, I took the cat checking the territory.
Yeah.
Every day, who knows? Cats knows what I mean. They check it every day, and every change you make, they check and put into their kind of take up in their body scheme, in their scheme of their environment. So this is a very basic thing. And the interesting thing of the bilateral brain, obviously, is that we decouple this in a stronger way and are able to make to reflect on this difference between. That we realize that something is not there, for example. That mm-hmm. we realize something does not make sense.
Mm-hmm.
And this is interesting because we can talk about memory in a different way, in a more kind of analytical way. And can I also understand, and we are talking about 1.5 million and 2 million years when that happens, but the idea is that we can understand how we as humans became able to not only think about, let's say, a cat, I don't know, I think they have a kind of memory of persons, which is half a year or so. There is research on that.
Right.
And that we are able to overlook thousands of years
yeah.
and develop cultural storages of memories, cultural technologies, artifacts which help us to remember. Huge amounts of kilometers and so it's a different size, so to say, which is not just a different size, but a different complexity, mm. which develops through this. And what it allows us to do is to look at situations where we think we already know what memory is in a different way. That makes it interesting. Say that religious systems are kind of a solution to the problem of memory, that you define memory not just as an ability of humans, but also as a precondition, more neutral mm-hmm. precondition, and even as a problem which humans need to solve.
Mm.
So the difference between this schema we have, the memory we expect and compare to, and the actuality, there can be strong clashes
mm-hmm.
and that there is always a difference. And we can't, you know, this is, of course, the natural science view. We can't close the gap, so to say. And the idea of the natural sciences is, natural scientists is often, okay, humans are inclined to bridge the gap or close the gap, erase the difference. And this is the way then they then often discuss that religions are systems which offer us to close the system. And I think this is a very Christian way of thinking about religions. And for me, it opened up much more to look at religions in terms of how do they deal with that difference? How do they deal with the awareness of a difference between now and then, between what I maybe want to believe and what doesn't fit anymore. Mm-hmm. And the whole idea of that religions need to fit into the societies they are good for or no longer good for. So mm-hmm. religious change can be theorized from that angle. This is one thing that, that you look at religious systems in terms of this theory, but then discover a huge diversity in dealing with a difference, so to say. If you look at Buddhism, it's not just that they deconstruct the reality we empirically get by our senses. I mean, I know there is no universal empirical. I mean, that's the interesting thing of the aesthetic approach. There is no uncultural empirical perception of the world. It's always already cultural. But at the same time, there is the opportunity to develop a second reality and an alternative reality. And Buddhism is, of course, based on the idea and the practice to say this is what you are producing here and perceiving here is not the only version, yeah. so to say. It's the version which has to do with samsara and with your attitude to reality. Mm-hmm. So they deconstruct. They don't only say this is not the real world.
Yeah.
There is a better one. But they say they deconstruct your perception of this reality. And they do not offer, that's the interesting thing, another paradise or hell or whatever, but they offer a practice which actually addresses the gap.
Yeah.
Offer to say you can be in the gap.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this shows, and Brian Bocking was so kind to say yesterday, we always need to be smarter in our theory than the models of religions are. You know,
yeah.
And this is true. If you dive into, I mean, there are also simplicities, of course, or simplifications. But this is what we can contribute to this debate, I think, and is necessary to contribute, that we show that religions are much more diverse and complicated and interesting also in how they, in this case, relate to the gap.
Yeah.
Then the natural scientific discussion also can see, if they want to refer to our knowledge, this can really be a very, very interesting discussion.
Mm. Throughout this, I'm conscious of the time, so we will probably be wanting to finish up shortly, but I've been really struck at how well-focused this conference has been. It doesn't normally happen, and if I had presented a paper, it wouldn't have been so focused. But everyone has been using a whole diversity of approaches to religion and memory, and applying it in a variety of different situations. So, you know, I've seen, I recorded an interview with Owen this morning, Owen O'Mahony. You chaired his paper yesterday about, statues and pilgrimages and all these sorts of things. We've seen censuses being interpreted with ideas of religion and memory my mind's drawing a blank as the other examples, but I've seen constant different ways of applying it. Where, I guess, to sort of draw to a close, in a sort of optimistic, looking to the future sort of way, where would you like to see more work done in this area? I think you've got your own plans for future work, where are there gaps in our disciplinary memory of religion and memory?
Yeah, interesting question. I think one of the panels I couldn't unfortunately hear and see was about forgetting.
Yeah.
And I think, first of all, it's a good sign that everybody could relate to the concept. Sometimes I hear criticism that things are too broad and I think or want to explain everything. And mm-hmm. I don't think that these concepts are meant kind of in an imperial way. It's more a tool, I think.
Yeah.
And the great sign was that you can make use of the tool in many different ways.
Yeah.
And this is what we saw. And I like the title of Memory, Remembering and Forgetting. This is something I also learned from Hubert Moore, the aesthetic of religion inventor, so to say. Always turn it around. Mm-hmm. Turn the concept around. And look, formation and destruction, deformation, aesthetics and anesthetics, not feeling. This was the concept I was learning, about this turning around. And forgetting is one thing. How do we erase signs?
Yeah.
Can we erase memories? And how is it done? Of course we can. But it's also, it has its own strategies because you can't forget on purpose. That's not possible. And maybe coming back to this idea, what can we learn from the basis of physiology, cognitive, emotional elements of memory, remembering? I think the aspect that I just mentioned, that it's not just an ability and not just the big systems of memorizing and so on, but that memory also can mean that it leads a life on its own,
mm-hmm.
that we are forced to memorize all the situations where memories cannot be bared. We talked about traumatic post-traumatic stress this morning in Cambodia.
I wasn't that bad.
So this is nothing else than not being able to cope with memories which are so awful that our mind would not be, you know, ready to respond. Streams of memory. Mm-hmm. I mean, ask an artist what happens when you dive into a work of art connected to memories which are stronger than your kind of creative apparatus is able to cope with.
Yeah.
So there is a dimension of memory, memorizing, which at the same time could be described on the level of what our mind and body and emotions are able to do, and what it does mean if this does not work anymore, so to say. And at the same time, we are back in Ireland and all the countries in the world where this is a complicated thing. What would this help us to understand why it's so hard to overcome the conflicts and to find creative and more processual ways of remembering, memorizing together? And this is what we, of course, know, that learning about the memory of the other is the beginning of a way of understanding and acceptance, which does not mean to give in, or which does not mean to lose the own history and story, so to say. Yeah. So I think turning the concept around, there is still a lot of, you know, a lot to do.
Yeah. And I wonder if religious studies itself, you know, clings to a memory of it, of the sort of disciplinary foundation, the traumatic, you know, separation from theology, which has then led to this constant reflection on what is religious studies, which maybe is a problematic memory that should be forgotten. And also there's the memory of Protestant Christian belief-centered approaches to religion that is very difficult for us to forget, in that sense that every time within religious studies you try and use a new model, people tend to lapse back into their memory of what religion implicitly is. So
I mean, you're talking to a German, so wishing for forgetting is not the way we were brought up. And I'm not talking about political correctness, but really about that memory and history is something which is a rich an enrichment of tradition, and gives me, for example, the opportunity also to look critically, but also hopeful at the role of my home country, so to say. And I see that memory and history playing a role in feuilletons and in newspapers on a high level. I miss sometimes, not here in Ireland, not definitely, but, you know, when I'm abroad. And sometimes I think we do have a good culture of memory and awareness of history. So forgetting, as I said, forgetting on purpose doesn't function, so to say. And I mean, I must say I'm a lucky one. I don't have a trauma with theology at all.
Yeah.
I was brought up in Tübingen, a very, you know, methodologically and theoretically oriented place to study the study of religion. But of course, I know about the interesting and sometimes very complex interrelation with Christian, you know, Christian part of our culture, which is much deeper than ideological or disciplinary borders. And I find interesting that simply academic arguments saying there is a difference how we produce knowledge, and there is a difference how we put our systematic questions, that this is sometimes seen as kind of offending, or that people think you are afraid to refer to religious positions. But this is something I don't really understand, because I only see very clear differences in how we approach this vast field we call religion. So let's work on that.
Well, on that note, that has been great, and I will end there. So thank you very much.
Thank you. It was a nice way to rethink the conference together with you.
To remember it.
Thanks for that, Chris. That's That's a subject we've wanted to have on the Religious Studies Project since day one, 4 years ago. So thanks for sorting that out. And I'm equally excited that we have Hannah Holtschneider writing the response, not only a friend of ours, but a very good scholar. So that's... Mm-hmm.
In fact, I think she was the first lecture I ever had in religious studies at the University of Edinburgh was with Hannah Holtschneider. So
she was actually involved in the very earliest stages of setting up the project. She was the first person I spoke to.
Sort of negotiator.
Yeah, like outside of yourself, she was the first person involved. So, you know, just to sort of negotiate whether Edinburgh might be interested in some things like that. So.
Yeah.
So it's great to have her involved, yeah.
So that's a memory there.
There, yeah.
We've also both got quite a few memories that have been generated over the past few weeks of interviews that we've recorded, conferences that we've been to. I think I'll let David do a bit more talking just because I was monopolising the interview there. But you were at the British Association for the Study of Religions annual conference. They're our principal sponsor, of course. You were there last week.
I was indeed. It was a quieter conference than last year, with the last year being the EASR and IAHR Congress, is that right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it was quite a small affair, and there was a lot of people who were missed, yourself included, and Jim Cox and Steve Sutcliffe. But it was good. It was a collegial kind of affair. Mm-hmm. A lot of chat and very friendly. I managed to record two interviews plus a roundtable and the Christmas special. Mm-hmm. The Christmas special is becoming a bit of a institution now, I think, at the BASR conference.
Yeah, I don't know what responsibility we've taken on there.
I know it's yeah.
Looking forward.
We
to
both
it.
Entertain and educate.
Absolutely.
But yeah, it was great. It was great. There was you know, much discussion about the RSP at the committee meeting, but you know, I'm sworn to secrecy, and we'll talk more about that. We haven't talked about it, in fact, so I can't say too much. But yeah,
good.
Our relationship with the BASR continues apace.
Excellent. That's good to hear. Just listeners, in terms of next week, what we've got is an interview that Tommy Coleman recorded with Andrew Johnson on Pentecostalism in the prisons of Brazil. Which should be quite interesting. There's a lot of research been done in sort of prison chaplaincy, religion in prisons. We haven't featured any of that. Also, Pentecostalism. Haven't featured any interviews on that either. So we look forward to that interview. In terms of future topics coming up, we've got a whole variety of things. We've got more on vernacular religion. We've got post-secular. We've got bricolage.
I'm particularly interested in, there's a couple on sort of witchcraft and things like that.
And shamanism, spiritualism.
Mm-hmm. And that fits in with hopefully that'll culminate in this roundtable about non-ordinary realities. Tanya Lerman, prayer, pretense and personification, how God becomes real. That's got to be a big draw for anyone.
Yeah.
And don't forget to mention our Christmas special.
Absolutely. So yeah, we've got a packed program up until Christmas for you. For now, we've been wittering on for a wee while. We'll say the usual Facebook, where we've just passed 2,000 followers, likes, as they're called on Facebook. So thank you to the 2,000 of you. Keep spreading the word. We're really pleased with that. Twitter, iTunes, Google+, and remember you can support us through our Amazon links. For now, from the Wash Bar in Edinburgh,
thanks for listening.